And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week, we're crossing the nation from the swamplands of Florida to the heartland and finally to California as we bring to life the stories that deserve attention in the realms of nature. We update the story of the ivory-billed woodpecker, visit a tropical rainforest in Iowa, and end up in Southern California, where our community is leading the way towards a powerful alliance of local government and the people it serves. And of course, the news. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth commences following this brief intermission.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's been a quiet week across America. No hurricanes or sensational storms. No floods or devastation. So not much of a sensational nature in the news. And actually, with just a month left before the midterm elections, silence from the environmental front may be the worst sound of all. Yesterday, President Bush held a news conference, and as has happened so often before, during election time, not a single question about the environment. And quite frankly, you can't fault the president about that. It may be more appropriate to throw some light on the opposition, which seems perhaps afraid to raise serious issues about global warming or the need for dramatic national leadership for energy independence. At least a whimper or two about the devastation of West Virginia's mountains to the mountaintop removal methods of the coal companies. Most of the real political action is happening in the states, which are being forced to cut their own path to sustainability. And today, we take a look at how one California city is continuing its leadership role in forging a functional future for its citizens. We talk with the mayor of Irvine, California, in segment 3. And who'd ever thought we'd be hearing about the tropical rainforests of Iowa? Well, it's a dream that's becoming a reality. During segment 2, we talk with the executive director of Earth Park as he prepares to help create one of the nation's most extraordinary environmental learning centers. And then following the news, we bring you an update from those swamps of Florida on that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker from Dr. Jeffrey Hill of Auburn University. And he invites you to officially join his research team to determine once and for all whether the ivory bill is back. It's all coming up, but as always, we bring you this week's Nature Newsmakers. So now, the news. For people who still doubt the validity of global warming, the proof may come in the form of a bill in the mail from their insurance providers who are becoming vocal with warnings that those who must pay for the damages wrought by hurricanes, floods, and forest fires aren't willing to play politics with the facts. A report issued jointly by the Alliance Group, an insurer, and the World Wildlife Fund warned that global warming will push up insurance premiums in high-risk areas like coastal Florida and other hurricane-prone parts of the United States. The report, entitled Climate Change and Insurance, An Agenda for Action in the United States, made it clear that there is direct correlation between climate change, forest fires, storm surges, and people's livelihoods, said Carter Roberts, president of the World Wildlife Fund in the U.S. Beyond setting the correct premiums on areas expected to bear the brunt of global climate change, both said insurers need to work with governments to make sure construction in those areas dealt with the risk and did not continue as business as usual. The report stressed that government-subsidized flood insurance may have encouraged people to live in high-risk zones and suggested that these subsidies end. So consider yourself warned. And in a similar vein, serious opposition regarding climate change is melting, in large part due to the undeniable increased melting of glaciers around the world. As a matter of fact, Dr. George Kaiser, a glaciologist at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, said, "We are in a terminal meltdown. Glaciers are going to melt and melt until they are all gone. There are not any glaciers getting bigger anymore." Dr. Kaser said that 99.99% of all glaciers were now shrinking. Dr. Kaser concludes as well that this terminal condition is exacerbated by human contributions to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. Lest anyone still offer objections, we suggest that a trip to Glacier National Park may be instructive. Of the 150 glaciers that once defined the park, only 27 remain. So there. And if that isn't enough, did you know that the repeating extinction of mammal species every 2.5 million years, followed by a huge increase in mammal species, a phenomenon which has baffled scientists for a very long time, is in fact due to periodic wobbles in the Earth's orbit? And here's where it gets complex. It seems that when the Earth is in a fairly circular orbit around the Sun, the summer and winter temperatures are more stable, which causes the glaciers to expand, oceans to decline, and changes in rainfall. Now, as the orbit becomes more elliptical, the seasons become more extreme. Add to this the changes in the tilt of the Earth, which is currently at 23 degrees, and which changes every million years, and you have a montage of overlapping species fluctuations that will take thousands of years to prove. But all is not lost. Scientists discover 2 to 3 new bird species each year. The most recent newly identified species comes from a remote cloud forest in Colombia. The little finch, recently identified, is a dandy example of senseless wonder. More colorful than a punk rock star, the little bird sports vivid red cap, yellow breast and belly feathers, with a broad head-to-tail black stripe that puts this little beastie boy among the top new fashions of the fall season. Given the name Yaracuyas after the indigenous tribe that shares the forests, the new bird species, which is considered quite rare, is provided with natural protection as 200,000 acres of national park was recently declared, which happens to be exactly where the Yaracuyas bushfinch chooses to live. And this week marked a momentous migration of 18 whooping cranes, which were headed south on a 1,228-mile journey from Wisconsin to Florida. A couple of factors make this noteworthy. First, these 18 make up a sizable proportion of the total of 214 wild whoopers, which have grown from a very few individuals over the last 40 years and represent the entire population of wild whooping cranes. But perhaps equally as amazing is that these young whoopers took off on their first leg of the journey following their surrogate mothers, namely 4 ultralights, to which the birds have been carefully bonded since birth. If all goes well, these young whooping cranes will follow their adoptive moms to Florida, overwinter there, then return on their own in the spring. We say bon voyage and Godspeed. And that's the news. A few reminders. While you're camped down in the swamps of Florida searching for the ivory-billed woodpecker or building that first morning fire in the high country to put some hot Java into your fingers, it's always nice to have a little helper getting that fire started. The best little friend you can have is the air grill blower. A few cranks and a whirlwind of directed air takes those embers of kindling and turns them into the perfect fire. You can have one for free if you are the 5th emailer to send an email to me with air grill blower in the subject line. Do it now. Email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net with air grill blower in the subject line. And you just may have this handy fire helper at your next fire. Next week, we're surveying the state of the environment in the upcoming elections. It's a very important show. You'll want to tune in. So now, we head on out to Alabama and Auburn University. A couple of weeks ago, I had a great breaking news story coming out of Auburn University and ultimately Florida about a new sighting of the ivory-billed woodpecker, and we had a great interview with Dr. Jeffrey Hill. It was a really fascinating show. Well, I thought it'd be important for us to get back with Dr. Hill and see what's happened since he broke this news. Dr. Hill, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Now, hi, Sydney. Glad to be back.
Well, of course, the first thing that I'm sure everybody wants to know is any new significant sightings since your last report?
No, not from my group, not along the Choctahatchee. This is a very quiet period in the swamp, but not just ivory-billed, but most species of birds are very quiet this time of year. We still have full leaf coverage in the forest. It's hard to see much. So this is the time of year we expect to detect these birds the least, and we're not down there very much right now. My students are busy in school, and I'm busy dealing with our announcement.
Well, since that time, you've had a chance to present your findings to some fairly large forums. What's been the response by the scientific community?
Well, it's been very encouraging and very supportive. So we made our announcement through a press release, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, and got some coverage in newspapers. And in response to that, I had hundreds of emails and phone calls. And every single email I got has been pleasant and positive. Not everybody believes we have ivory bills. There's a lot of skeptics out there, and that's understandable. But I was a little afraid we might draw out, I don't know, anger or just sort of inappropriate response, but I've had none of that. Whether people are skeptics or believers, they've sent me nice, encouraging emails.
Mm. Well, I had the opportunity to look at some of the bird blogs which are out there, and there's been a very interesting debate going on there, which I'm sure you're aware of.
I try not to look at blogs too much because I was doing a little bit right before our announcement, and actually it gets a little upsetting and a little depressing. And it really, I think, doesn't represent the views of 99% of the people interested in birds in North America.
It's been interesting. And just because I happened to see this on one of the blogs, birdforum.org, this was an interesting take. They suggest, one of the threads, the suggestions, was that in reality, you were working for the anti-development forces in Florida because there just so happens that there is a major airport that's being planned in that area, and that you were, all of this was being concocted to try to create some distraction and legal means to stop the development. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really crazy coincidence, I admit. I had no knowledge of the airport development until a reporter called me up and explained it to me after our announcement. Apparently, this airport was approved 10 days before our announcement. But I'm not a Florida resident. I don't read Florida newspapers, and I had no idea about this.
That's just amazing because now this has become central to that debate. Isn't that something?
Yeah, and I don't even know how central it is. I'm no part of that debate to this point. I imagine I'm going to get drawn into it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what are your plans now as you go onward here into the future?
Well, we're trying to get organized for a much larger, more organized search for the winter and spring 07 season. And we're actually right now trying to hire a group of full-time technicians to assist us with this search.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about what your needs are and how that's progressing and what they can expect, and go ahead and give some details.
Yeah, the main thing we're looking for is a time commitment by physically fit people. So we really need to have degree of commitment because we need to put people in these areas and have them work day after day so they become familiar. So, yeah, some continuity. So we're looking for people that can commit from early January through May. And we'll certainly consider somewhat abbreviated commitments. If they have to shave a month off at the beginning or end, we may consider that. But we really would like people that can make this whole commitment. Now, ideally, we would take people who are the top field ornithologists, the top bird identifiers in the country. But I'm afraid we're not going to get 16 people like that. That's how many techs we're looking to hire.
16, yeah, that's a good crew.
Yeah, we'll be a good group if we can pull it off. So really, I think our number one requirement is that the people that sign up for this be physically fit and willing to live under fairly harsh conditions. These people are going to be camping in tents down in the swamp for weeks at a time, and the ability to do that supersedes anything else. We can actually train people to identify these birds and know what they sound like. I'd rather have people come in with excellent bird skills, but really, you know, an excellent birder who does nothing but complain about the swamp and the cold and stuff would be worse than a novice birder who is fine with the rough conditions.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Now, you're also, interestingly enough, offering a small stipend to allow these people to spend that time.
That's right. We are offering a very small stipend. We're offering $1,200 a month with no benefits. These will just come in as temporary employees of the university. Interestingly, this is the stipend I've offered throughout my career. I just adjusted for inflation over the years. A very small stipend. And I've never been without temporary workers for my various projects, much less exciting and nationally prominent than the Ivoryville search.
Mm-hmm. And what will these people spend their time doing? That's quite a commitment. That's about 5 months. How will they spend their time?
Well, we're still developing our approach, and actually if people have ideas, they can share them with me about how they think the Ivoryville search should best go. But we want to be very careful to have a quiet presence in the swamp. We don't want to pour in there with an army and surround these shy birds and potentially drive them out of areas. So our ideas right now are to subdivide a pretty good section of the swamp into search territories, assign search territories to our workers, and then they'll go in each day in their fairly small territory, probably less than a square mile, and just very quietly move about and try to detect these birds.
So you'll be working with technology such as recorders, I suppose, maybe some parabolic mics, cameras?
Not parabolic mics. Those would be big and awkward. Our main technical approach to this whole search is going to be remote cameras. And this is something we completely lacked last year. We had just a very limited numbers of conventional cameras. But there's now very good game cameras available that will allow you to take a time-lapse still photography series of an object. So these are the sort of cameras we could put facing cavities or feeding trees and get multiple days' worth of images. So we can set these things and leave them and come back and retrieve them. And if a bird has come in to a cavity or a feeding tree, we'll know it. Its image will have been captured. I believe that the image of an ivory bill is going to be very anticlimactic. I think it's going to be a little black and white still picture of a bird on a feeding tree or going to a cavity. It's going to be very boring, but it's going to be definitive, hopefully.
Well, that'll change the history of the ivory bill definitively, and that'll be real interesting. And I wish you great luck on your efforts here and great success. For people who want to contact you and perhaps look into your research, but as well who may be considering joining you in the field as a researcher, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Well, my graduate student, Brian Rolek, who was the main searcher last year in the swamp, is the person receiving applications for the search. And Brian's email address is Brian Rolek, all one word, B-R-I-A-N-R-O-L-E-K, at Gmail, G-M-A-I-L, .com. Anybody interested in Ivoryville can also go to our website that we've posted, www.auburn.edu/Ivoryville, and that links to Dan Mennell's Sound web page. It has a description of how to apply for a position. It has, for those who can only come down for a few days and want to search, we have suggestions for how people that aren't part of the organized search can get into this area. We want anybody interested to come in, and you know, it's very likely just a birder visiting is going to get the key picture that we really need.
One of the great things about the website is the fact that you've really posted all of your relevant research. So for people who are interested, they can go there and really become part of this and follow it. It's a terrific place to learn more.
Yeah, we thought the best approach was just to lay it all out there so skeptics and believers alike can see what the evidence is and assess it for themselves.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Hill with Auburn University, I want to thank you for lending your voice here, and we'll keep in touch.
Oh, yeah, I'll be happy to give you an update in a few months when we have something new from the Choctahatchee.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
You'll find links to Dr. Hill's website on today's show page. Global warming is real, but a tropical rainforest at Iowa by 2010? You can count on it. You'd best stay tuned to hear what's coming. when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week, a broadly diverse group of philanthropists, scientists, educators, and state and local politicos announced that Iowa was 3 years away from seeing its first tropical rainforest springing up in the middle of the soybean and corn fields. And they're excited at the prospect. What's driving this unusual proclamation? You'll have to keep listening to find out when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. There's good news coming from many sectors that counters some of the news that puts us off a bit. The movement towards creating a sustainable world is really catching on. And possibly no more right now this week than some news that's coming out of central Iowa about the ultimate environmental experience that I'm aware of in the United States. It's a very exciting new project called Earth Park. And I'm very delighted to have as our guest right now the executive director of Earth Park, David Ullman. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, Sydney, thank you. It's fun to be with you and look forward to your questions and talking about this exciting project we have here in the U.S.
Let's first of all give our listeners a concept of what it is that Earth Park hopes to be.
Well, Earth Park is aimed at a pretty lofty goal, and that is at being an environmental center for the United States. We don't have a project that really has that specific of a mission. Our board mission statement is inspiring generations to learn from the natural world. How do we do that? In person at a very large, complex center that will include about a 3.5 to 4 acre enclosed rainforest biome with connections to environmental hotspots globally. Anchored in learning with a lot of engaging kiosks, exhibits, and galleries for learners of all ages, and virtually with a very robust internet presence, similar to what you do, hopefully, as good as what you do. But we want to be able to use the information, the connections, some of the curricula that our educators have beginning to come up with, and share that with people all over, regardless of whether or not they're ever able to come to the Midwest and see our project.
This is in Iowa, and of course, I think there's a number of people who are going to say, why Iowa?
Well, that's a fair question. Iowa is certainly not the largest state in our country, but it's a state that celebrates two great values that we have for well over 100 years. This is a state that is a leader in our country in education. Our students always test number one or number two. We're a very literate state. We're also well-traveled. Iowans have the distinction of being a pupil with the highest percentage who have passports, so we like to go elsewhere and see other people's dreams. But we're also centrally located near the intersection of two of our country's busiest interstates, 80 east-west and Interstate 35 north-south. We're going to build this project on a large 15,000-plus acre lake, the largest body of water between the Ozarks and Lake Mille Lac up in northern Minnesota, where you're from. And we're of a place that not only is grounded in education, but I'll finish the thought, it's also a place where we're grounded in conservation. We take environmental stewardship quite seriously. And I attribute a lot of that to our agricultural heritage and the fact that we pay attention to soil and water quality. So for all those reasons, plus the fact that our benefactor and our board and our former governor and others who have worked on this project all live here, that's why the project will be built in the state of Iowa.
This follows on a successful project in England that kind of defined the possibilities for a very large-scale environmental center, environmental learning center. Why don't you talk about the Eden Project?
Well, I'm happy to do that, too. We've become, on a personal basis, well acquainted with and friends of the team that planned and brought forth the Eden Project in Cornwall 5 years ago. They're great people. They're tenacious Brits. They're good marketers, but they're also grounded in education, and they, too, have a story of celebrating the environment. And I would encourage people to look at that project's website, Eden, E-D-E-N, as in the Garden of Eden, edenproject.com. And on that, they'll find a wealth of information. Eden is in Cornwall. It's about 5 hours west of London on the isthmus or tip of England that juts out to the Atlantic. It's not easily a place you could get to, but it's well worth the effort. And they've created this spectacularly large biome, about 150 feet tall, big trees, thousands of various plant species, and you are in there, you feel the humidity and the heat, you feel like you're in a real living, breathing rainforest. And about a year ago, they added on an educational center called the Core. Here's what's most impressive, I believe, in addition to the content. In 5 years, they have seen 8 million visitors come to Eden, people from all over the continent, some from the U.S. After your experience, you come away with a whole new appreciation for plants, for nature, for the stewardship that we need to provide, and it celebrates what people can do and the difference that we can make. And they are a team that has given us a lot of good information. We share the same architect, the Grimshaw firm out of London, New York, and they are eager for us to become their U.S. counterpart, and we certainly are looking forward to doing that.
From what I understand, this is going to be a total immersion experience. We're going to talk about the enclosure itself. This is a destination point. You can literally come here and spend time. There's going to be places to stay and a larger landscape. Talk about what the totality of this experience will include.
That's a really good question, and I appreciate you asking that. We are aiming the project at being something that could be a wonderful resource for people, whether they be casual visitors or more purposeful in doing ecotourism and trying to come someplace in the upper Midwest and really learn, whether they're spending half a day or a day or 3 days with the scientists and with the master teachers on site. We will build, again, about a 3.5 to 4 acre biome covered with a Teflon-like material from a German firm called Foiltech. Very interesting design, very iconic, different kind of building, powered by an array of alternative renewable energy sources. We hope, indeed, that the building itself will teach about efficient design and construction. The overall site that we'll be sitting on is a beautiful wooded tract, mature trees, and it will be next to this large, very large body of water. There will be some green hotels. There'll be nearby a wonderful small community and a lot of other visitor amenities that people will be able to take in. In addition to spending time, there'll be a couple hotels, a water park for kids. So it'll be a fun overall experience. We hope people will want to spend 2 or 3 or 4 days on site.
There's every reason to have fun and learn at the same time.
You know, thank you for saying that, too, because learning fun are not mutually exclusive. In fact, most of the surveys will tell you that there's better retention, better memory when experiential learning is fun. And a lot of science centers, museums, botanical facilities, and others are also aware of that and are trying to freshen up the experience. And we certainly want to launch with something that has a great, colorful variety of plant life, some animals, reptiles. We'll have about a 600,000-gallon aquarium, fresh water, recreating the flooded rainforest, and it's all about giving people a variety of exciting experiences. We're also going to load in some high technology and some virtual reality experiences that can put people literally in other places around the planet. We think a lot of people, particularly young ones, will just find a lot of excitement in that.
Most nature centers cater towards schools and family visits, but this really is going to be a family experience. That's a different sort of way to approach environmental learning on a family basis. It's a form of localized ecotourism.
Well, it clearly is, and again, we honor what's gone before, but our architects, Grimshaw, Sir Grimshaw, and others have been very clear to us that we want to respect our visitor, our learners, plural, and not dumb it down. We do want people to have fun, but we don't want to just have a little plaque that they read as they go by in a linear route. We want to have a lot of interactive learning, again, some kiosks and some opportunities for people to make inquiry-based learning possible, and they can spend as much or as little time as they want. The architects are working to come up with with multiple routes through the biome, so you don't just start at point A and end at point B, troll along following somebody right in front of you, but we'll be able to cross-cut between the cloud forest, recreated jungle, and also the flooded Amazon waters experience, and move in and out from a learning core that will have information in it. So it's all aimed at what's known as free choice learning. Give people the right to do what they want to do. And again, if we're smart about it, and we have a lot of work to do to map it all, but if we can robustly use the Internet, encourage people to be online with us before and after their experience, you can sort of extend the learning moment. People can be a little better prepped when they come and then hopefully have a great time and then go home and can stay in touch with Earth Park. And their website will be earthpark.org. Should get that out there, and there are already some interesting information up on the net, more to come. But if we do it well and link to other good facilities like what you've talked about, we can have a real impact for learners all over, and help propel interest in the environment and in sustainable living.
You've got one of the greatest jobs in the world right now, and that is to dream about what is possible in terms of environmental learning. You get to start from the ground up here, find the best, and then put it inside. So give us at this point, I'm sure you have some really terrific visions of what that experience will be like. Give us some highlights.
Well, we're blessed to have good people on this team. Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa helped a few years ago with funding to put together an education design team. And we got some of the smart people in the ranks of education, formal education, K-12, public and private, and also higher ed, not only from Iowa but from around the country, to dream, to do some charrettes and think about content and design and come up with what we could do. And more recently, Senator Grassley from Iowa has helped with some assistance from the Department of Energy as well. They're very interested in, again, the alternative and renewable energy technology sources that could be applied to fuel the building, run it, and the life support systems on the inside. Back on the learning front, we hope to, as I said, have learners of all ages. We'll probably see about 100,000 young people through on an annual basis. That's quite a bit, actually. We're learning from, again, what they're doing at the Eaton Center in the U.K. One of the things, Sydney, that I think really is exciting is that there is some specific thinking oriented to teachers. If we lose a lot of teachers in society, people who go to school, get an education major, teach for 3 to 5 years, and check out because of relatively low pay or discipline issues, whatever, in the classroom. We unfortunately lose a lot of our best teachers at a relatively young age. The thought here would be that if we could create a really exciting 21st century environmentally themed learning center where these young teachers could come maybe 5 years into their career, recharge their battery, hang with other teachers, work with master teachers, and rejuvenate themselves and remind themselves of why they get into teaching in the first place, and then send them out armed with great new information, context. Maybe we keep some in the profession, particularly in science and in environmental science, as the demand for more information on those fronts grows. We think if we just could do that, in addition to obviously building, opening, and running this well, we would have made a great contribution.
Nothing works better for teachers than to get into a situation like that where suddenly their eyes are open to all sorts of new opportunities. I know I've been through that many times myself. And you think you got a pretty good handle on something, and then someone says, here, why don't you try this? Why don't you try mapping the area? And just all sorts of different techniques that bring excitement to learning. And that's critical for a successful learning back in the classroom. That's a great tie-in.
Well, it all starts with good teaching, and we're fortunate in this country. We have thousands of great teachers. Unfortunately, as the boomers age, you and I among them, in the decade of the teens, we're going to lose some of the very best teachers in this country. We've got to recruit a new core of people and then keep them in the profession and keep them excited about teaching for decades to come. You're absolutely right. The environment is only going to become more important, more information as it's threatened will be out there. And if we can't be a place that helps enable the transfer of information, give people those kinds of touch points, then, again, we'll be helping. And we want to learn from a lot of others, and we're getting a lot of good suggestions, good ideas from people all the time, and we're grateful for those.
This will be a recreation of a rainforest environment, so that when you walk in from, it's a 20 below zero outside on a February, and you walk in, that's going to be kind of nice all by itself.
Well,
paradise in Iowa. That's interesting.
it may be 20 below in the Canadian border, but we rarely get that cold here. We may have a handful of days at zero or slightly below zero. But the wintertime at Eden, again in the UK, they do very well over there for that very reason. People like the respite.
Oh yeah.
I can just it'll be fun all four of our distinct seasons, we believe.
Having lived in Minnesota, I can just imagine these people in the parkas and the snow boots coming in and ripping them off, and just wanting to be there for relaxation.
Well, let me build a big coat room.
You're going to have a huge coat room. It'll actually be a parka room. Yeah.
Right.
Now you're going to have a 600,000 gallon aquarium. Configure that for me, so that the people have a picture of that in their mind.
We don't expect to look like the Shedd Aquarium, if I could use that as an example, or more recently, the spectacular new aquarium in Atlanta, Georgia, which is about close to 5 million gallons, gargantuan in size. We will not just have tanks. There may be some of those, but mostly what we want to do is mimic what happens in the real rainforest with the incredible amount of rain that they get in the rainforest. You see the rise and fall of the water table down there. In some parts of the rainforest, they get 400 inches of rain. And we took some from our science and design team to Brazil just last January, about 9 months ago. And we were in small boats every day on the Amazon and its tributaries. And the scale, the story of the flooded rainforest, the story of water in that ecosystem is integral. That's why it's called the rainforest. If we can capture a slice of that and tell that in a compelling way, it will be fun. So it won't be your classic aquarium where you'll just be staring at a 12-foot high tank, but it will be integrated with the trees. There will be fish, some reptiles and amphibians around, and it should be a fun experience.
Now, are you also going to have mammals free roaming and that type of thing?
Well, it's under consideration. There are some who are championing that. If you want to have a true ecosystem, obviously that would be a part of it. There are cost issues involved there and some visitor issues that need to be taken into account, setbacks, and not only for the safety of our guests, but also for the safety of the animals. And I think we'll see that in a limited way. Certainly we'll see a lot of very colorful birds. But I don't know that we'll see a lot of animals. At the Eden Project, you see zero. They have birds in there, but they don't really have any other species.
Also, virtual reality. This is something I've always been fascinated by. I've always had a dream of doing traveling tour where a person could go into a room and dial in an environment anywhere in the world and do, you know, surround visuals, sounds, and a sense of even humidity and different things. What's your dream for? I realize a lot of this, by the way, is in the planning stages, and you're very lucky. And I don't want to have you. Nothing that we're saying here is set in concrete, okay? Because you're in a planning stage here. But you know, what kind of vision are you looking at for your virtual reality chamber, a cell, a theater, an auditorium? What are you looking at there?
Well, we'd like to go north of what we see today, which is the IMAX experience. And those are terrific. We'd like to use a real digital format. We'd like to surround people. We'd like to have it be a little more intimate. We've got good people at Iowa State University up in Ames, where there's been some real excellent work for the last several years on virtual reality depictions, and others who are giving us good counsel. You said it well. Well, a lot of that's still under investigation. There are budget implications, to be sure. I'd say over the next year, a lot of that will be thought through much more than it is today. But we've raised the bar on ourselves to see if we can't create an experience like that in addition to what we have in the biome.
You've got some great partners who've helped launch this. I believe you're going to start groundbreaking in 2007. So give us a sense of who some of the principals are that have really helped to make this happen. You've already mentioned some. And then also, what are we looking forward to in terms of a timeline?
Well, good. We do have good partners, and you discover quickly when you work on something like this with a big vision, and then your team is charged with delivering that you... You've got to get a lot of help. Partnering counts for quite a bit, public sector and private. On the public side, again, good help from a number of educational institutions and individuals. The U.S. Department of Energy has been good. We are working with some firms in corporate America, many of which are excited about sustainability and retooling their own companies to be more environmentally responsible, and understanding also where the market is going, and that people expect that from those that they do business with. In the last few months, we've signed up the Siemens Corporation, the German company, as our technology partner. We've had multiple meetings with them, more recently two team meetings where each side's had six or seven people around the table mapping out the energy systems for the project. And so Siemens is a great firm. Long heritage over on the continent, not as well known in the U.S., but very good people committed to responsible environmental action, and we're elated that they're on this team. There are other companies with whom we're talking as well, and I hope soon to be able to share their names with you as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, groundbreaking 2007, and how long do you expect this?
Yes, you asked about the timetable, and I hopped over that. The groundbreak will be, we hope, roughly mid-year next year. And it's about a two and a half to three year build, and some time to populate the biome. So we're looking at best case probably mid 2010 as an opening, and we hope some pre-opening opportunities. And if I could not unduly talk about Eden, but again, I think it's helpful to do that, because if people can understand what goes on at Eden, they'll have a better sense of what we are going to do. They opened up that project early. In the summer of 2000, before it was completed, and they actually had people pay about £5, which at the time was about $8, to tour what in effect was a construction site.
That would be fun.
It was fun, and it taught people what was coming. It showed them the scale of the project, and it invested them in the story. It got them emotionally involved. So guess what? When they cut the ribbon and opened the doors, they all came back.
Oh, I'd be there any number of times.
Again, they've taught us well, and if we can generate that kind of interest here in the U.S., in the heartland, and again, with the Internet programs like yours, we can be talking to people in Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, and we really do believe that once this is open, people will find their way here. We've actually had some people in corporate America tell us that they're glad that we are in the heartland, that we're in the Midwest, that we're not on either coast, so that people can get here, and we're not jammed into a dense urban setting. We've got elbow room. We've got quiet. We've got beauty. We've got this incredible body of water, very placid, bucolic, special place, and a place to grow over time, too. And the years ahead.
People used to head to the cities to have a great time because there was a lot going on in the cities. Now the cities have become a bit challenging. It's hard to find a place to park. It's noisy. It's busy. Traffic is stuck. So guess what? People are heading out to the country.
You're exactly right. I think for our story, for what we're trying to share with people, it works best for us to be outside of that kind of congested space and in a place where people can look up and see the stars and look out and see these great sunsets and then go inside in this biome and take up, you know, wander and be full of wonder. And I think we've got a great location in Pella, Iowa.
Now tell me where that is. I want to know where that is so I can say in 2010 I'm going to plan a visit to Pella, Iowa.
Pella is a beautiful community of about 10, 11,000 people. It's about 40 minutes southeast of Des Moines, which mm-hmm. is the state capital of Iowa. And it's where Interstate 80 and Interstate 35 intersect. So we're just 40 minutes from that intersection, less actually from Interstate 80, due south of Interstate 80. It's a town with a proud Dutch heritage, a lot of windmills, and we're really having a lot of fun as we look at the possibility of using wind energy on site or maybe connected to some of the big wind farms in north central northwest Iowa. They've got these restored 19th century windmills. We may drop a couple of 21st century wind turbines right there next to the lake. And that's just to add a little irony to everything, but we couldn't have a better community. Wonderful people, very entrepreneurial, real excited about sustainability, and they're just great hosts. That site is only about a week and a half old. We just picked it. We had 16 communities in our state that at one time or another expressed some interest in hosting the project. We had a very deliberate site process that took us to 12 and 7 and 4 and finally to this one.
Well, I'm excited about being able to announce Pella as the site for the new Earth Park that is going to start groundbreaking in 2007 and take 3 years or so to put together, 2010. Great to know about this happening right now. It's an exciting opportunity. You and I will keep in touch, and we'll let the world know about Earth Park. David Ullman, the executive director of the Emerging Earth Park. One more time, where can people go to find out information about Earth Park?
First, Sydney, my thanks again to you for your interest and for the time in talking today and giving us the opportunity to share with people, your friends, people who care about these matters. Earthpark.org is the domain, and we would welcome people looking into that. They can find quite a bit of information about the plans for Earth Park, what will be inside and outside. We invite you and them to stay in touch with us as we go about the next few years of planning, designing, and building. That's going to be a very special time. And then once open, we'd love to see people come on here.
Well, David Ullman, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
You're welcome.
All these great ideas begin with a belief in possibilities. Then comes spreading the word, then leadership and commitment. That's the formula that has led one Southern California city's claim to being a model of what can be done when these factors take over. Yes, most of the real change is being born in the towns and cities across America. Stay tuned for a talk with a mayor who is definitely tuned in. She's coming up following this short break.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As in previous elections, despite the overwhelming concern by Americans generally about the changes in the environment that are becoming ever more evident every day, this midterm election remains mysteriously silent about the future. Some people, however, are no longer relying on national leadership and are taking control of their futures right in their own communities. In just a moment, you're about to hear a most impressive mayor speak about how their community won't be waiting to do the right thing. They're leading the way and building a strong, sustainable city right now. A great voice of the earth is about to speak up. So, stay tuned. Today, we heard in the news that we've been having this decrease in the cost of gasoline, and it's served us all very well. But the unfortunate thing is, for some reason, it sounds as if the price of gasoline is going to go up again. And for those of us who simply have to deal with our own lives, it's difficult enough to try to imagine how we accommodate these changes. But when you start to talk about a municipality, some of these changes become really difficult, and it's hard to even imagine how large-scale municipality deals with these kinds of things. They're taking all sorts of actions to try to look at a better future, a sustainable future, both economically and environmentally and socially and culturally. And one of the cities that really is taking that lead is the city of Irvine, California. And they're involved in a new project to advance a better future. And joining us now to talk about that is the mayor, Beth Crom. Welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
First question is, how does a city deal with these kinds of changes that are happening? I mean, it has to be difficult.
Well, you know, the question is not only how do cities do it, but why more cities aren't doing it, and what could be achieved if all cities were committing themselves through a variety of mechanisms to impacting climate change and reducing emissions, and understanding how to encourage both at a residential and business level a reduction in energy consumption and a move towards conservation and innovative technologies. So what we have been working to do here in the city of Irvine is to understand how we could enhance what has been a historic commitment to environmental stewardship and sustainability. But when I became mayor in 2004, and when I came on the council really in 2000, what I noticed was that we had been in a position of leadership throughout the 70s and 80s, not a lot of investment and effort in the 90s when there was a considerable shift in the policy of the council. But we had also become comfortable. We were sort of resting on laurels that had been developed early on, and there was a lot that we could be doing, and so that's what I've been working to try and affect through green building programs, through partnerships on energy reduction, through a project that we are doing to convert a decommissioned military base into the first great metropolitan park of the 21st century, and to do so in a fully sustainable way. And as you mentioned, through our partnership with Toyota and the National Fuel Cell Research Institute, test driving a hydrogen hybrid fuel cell vehicle, but also through our partnership through the Conference of Mayors with Cities for Climate Protection, with the Plug-in Partnership. So we are trying to focus on all fronts and help to educate the community so that we can ensure a brighter future, not just for our community, but for the world.
You know, it's kind of interesting, a commitment like Irvine's to this future sometimes, from some perspectives, becomes sort of politicized, suggesting somehow that, I know it's radical or too progressive or something, but really it isn't a political issue. It has to do with people. And I think that that's what you're committing to. Talk a little bit about that. You mentioned, for example, that more cities should be doing this. Why should they?
Well, you know, there is a hopeful sign in that issues like this were at you know, fairly recently considered sort of marginal issues, and I think they are being embraced much more in a mainstream way. The fact that a lot of the national leadership organizations have taken affirmative positions on climate protection and energy conservation, I think shows that what was once considered a fringe issue is now a mainstream issue, certainly with the focus that's been generated by An Inconvenient Truth and other things. But I can tell you that at a national level, the leaders that I work with come from all sides of the political spectrum, And even here in the city of Irvine, where we have representatives on our council of different political persuasions and philosophic positions, we have had unanimous support for our new green building program, both residential and commercial, as well as for the commitment with the development of the Orange County Great Park to using clean technologies, to ensuring drought-tolerant plantings and things that will help us conserve water, help us conserve energy. In fact, we're looking at ways to produce alternative forms of energy so that what we hope to create with this Great Park project is truly a living laboratory of innovative technologies where people can come and see buildings that are being powered by solar, by perhaps wind. You know, we've looked into all sorts of alternative energy opportunities and welcome the opportunity to help people see that things that we kind of have tended to think are way out there are technologies that can be employed today.
Well, it's fabulous, and I commend Irvine for its long-term commitment to this, and as well, Mayor Crom, yours very personally. It's obvious that you're very committed on a personal level to this, and you're also very articulate about this. Let's talk about this. Part of the effort, the partnerships that are emerging to advance a sustainable future are existing between communities like yourself or municipalities and as well the corporate sector and the NGO sector, and that's kind of what's developing in terms of your involvement in testing the Toyota fuel cell car, which is in partnership with the National Fuel Cell Research Center. You have the opportunity to test drive a Toyota fuel cell car. How long have you actually had this vehicle?
We've had the vehicle for about 6 months, and it is the chassis of a Toyota Highlander, but it is a fuel cell powered vehicle, and it's a very comfortable ride. It's a completely quiet ride, and you know, it's great to be able to take the vehicle out. I've worked with the local schools to help children see that this technology is emerging, and you know, I think that the fuel cell technology is just one piece of what is an overall effort to find ways to use alternative energy sources for fueling vehicles as well as other, you know, other of our energy needs. We are part of the Plug-In Partnership, which advances plug-in hybrid fuel cell, where you've got gasoline and electric,
mm-hmm.
and we think that that's important, too, to have many different fronts on which we're working, because bringing something into the mainstream is going to take some time. We have certain technologies, and, you know, here in Southern California, particularly in our area, we see so many Priuses on the road. We also have here in the city of Irvine Mazda Corporation, which is also working on a hybrid electric vehicle. So I think we need to look at all of these opportunities, not just one, and make sure that people see that they do have options available to them today, as well as technologies that may be available in the next few years.
Well, it's rather interesting. A fuel cell car is a hydrogen powered car. And I believe this one is 100% hydrogen powered.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Some people are suggesting that the workable fuel cells on a large scale basis maybe 10 years or so off. But let's talk about the technology and how this feels to you so that people can get a sense of its applicability. First of all, what everybody wants to know is how do you fuel this thing up?
Well, there's a hydrogen fueling station at the University of California at Irvine here in our city, which is where the National Fuel Cell Research Institute is housed. And actually, the institute takes responsibility for the fueling of the vehicle. So from my standpoint, I get to just hop in the car and have it fully fueled. But I think one of the real challenges that faces hydrogen technology is how to create hydrogen without using fossil fuels. Right now, in order to create hydrogen, you need to use some other type of fuel source. And obviously, I think long-term application of hydrogen technology is going to require us to find a clean way to produce hydrogen and a renewable way to produce hydrogen.
Well, the wonderful news is the fact that there's lots of people out there right now who are investing billions of dollars to develop exactly those things, and ultimately it's going to create our economies of the future. Hydrogen certainly is going to play a big role in the future. So, for example, solar and wind, you take water and you apply electricity from some source and you end up with hydrogen. It's fairly complex. I mean, it takes a lot of electricity to create hydrogen, but the source is water and conceivably sun or wind. That's not a bad mix.
Well, you know, somebody, I think it may have been the chancellor for the university when we rolled out the partnership with Toyota, was talking about the fact that, you know, when automobiles were just coming into usage, when, you know, everybody didn't have three automobiles in their garage, you know, the same kind of infrastructure had to be created in order to support gasoline-fueled technology. And so it isn't as if what we are ultimately going to have to do in order to provide the alternative fuel sources necessary for the energy of the future hasn't already occurred once in the last, you know, century when frankly it wasn't typical for everybody to have a vehicle and therefore there wasn't a gas station on every corner. And so I believe that the resources necessary in order to support innovative technologies can be produced. I think the reason we're feeling a little impatient is because perhaps we failed to be as proactive as we needed to be on these technologies 20 or 30 years ago. And now I think, you know, the good news is there's an emerging consensus that we really do need to do something. The bad news is by the time you get that level of consensus, it's usually 20 years past the point of being truly proactive. So I think there's a real urgency today. We recognize that we cannot depend on oil reserves indefinitely, and even if we could, we shouldn't because of the damage it's doing to our environment. And so I think we have a real opportunity now to bring all the parties to the table and try and advance things a little more rapidly.
I always look at this from both the environmental perspective, but as well the business perspective. And the truth is, there are people who are going to make billions and billions and billions of dollars off of these technologies in the future. There is no doubt. So it's a wise business decision. The transition from an oil-based economy into a sustainable economy, a city like Irvine will probably end up 10 years from now employing lots of people involved in these technologies and industries and put people back to work. And if we don't, the world is going to pass us by because the entire world is on a race to try to find solutions to the oil dilemma. And it's just a matter of time. So why not be in the pipeline?
Well, we actually have companies like Quantum Technologies here that are doing fuel cell research. You know, I think we are seeing not only the opportunity in the private sector to generate resources through these technologies, but, you know, one of the things that I think we really need to be exploring is the leveraging power that cities and states, that government has. You know, we are all purchasing vehicles for fleets. We are all building our own municipal facilities that we could be building in more sustainable ways. So if we were using public dollars to invest in those things which are not only good for our communities, but which help to create the kind of critical mass necessary in order to advance new technologies, if every city, which is fundamentally what the plug-in partnership is about, if every city said we would commit to purchasing five hybrid electric vehicles, that would, think about it, think about all the cities in America, if all every city agreed to do their share, that would create a market in and of itself. And so I think that's where we in municipal leadership can be more creative in our own thinking. Not just about what's important in our own city, but how, if we work together as cities, and I happen to believe that cities are the infrastructure that are holding up our country right now. I think we learned that with Katrina and other things, that at the end of the day, we are the ones that are on the front lines. We are the ones that are working directly with the citizens of this country, and we have a responsibility not only to educate, but to lead, and I think there's a lot we can be doing. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has just created a new committee on climate protection, which I've been invited to participate on, and look forward to exploring how we can encourage cities around the country to invest resources they would be investing anyway, but to do it in ways that help to advance technologies and also help to demonstrate to their citizens that they are environmentally responsible and interested in a sustainable world in the future.
You make such a valid point. It's so important. Many of us are hoping for some sort of national initiative to get these things rolling, but the truth of the matter is you're affecting millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people on a daily basis. You provide the support to keep those cities operating. I live down in San Diego, and I get on a freeway, and I'm always amazed at how all of us down here, it's 1.5 million people, manage to get along on the freeways, and we get our food delivered and things like that. It's a huge responsibility to keep this going. And the fact that the change now is coming from municipalities in terms of sustainability because they have to. They have
I think
no
that's the most hopeful sign, to be honest, is that we're not sitting on our hands and waiting for somebody else to do it, but that cities and municipal leaders are forging collaborations with organizations and the business community to look at how we can work together and leverage our opportunities to do more. We're actually going to be participating in a conference here on November 9th where we brought together the Urban Land Institute, representatives from the U.S. Green Building Organization, people from the sustainability consulting world, people from the development community, and we're putting on a conference that is called Orange and Gold and Green All Over, and the whole idea is to bring people who are invested on the environmental stewardship side and people who are engaged in developing here in Orange County and in business, and showing them models of people who have companies that have invested in building green, and why that has not only been important for the environment, but successful for those companies. We here in Irvine have a Ford Motor Company that's LEED certified building, and other examples of real positive corporate responsibility in demonstrating that the bottom line can be met while still advancing a vision that's much more sustainable for the future.
This is so interesting. This conversation was going to focus on the Toyota fuel cell car and Irvine's involvement in driving that one vehicle. And look where it's taken us, and it's a wonderful expansion of that topic. One of the things that's interesting about fuel cell cars, getting back to the topic at hand here, is the fact that they're quite amazing when you hop in one and you take it for a ride. Talk to me about what you're actually experiencing with the Toyota fuel cell car in terms of its drivability.
Well, In almost every respect, it drives as well, if not better, depending on what you're currently driving, as a traditional vehicle. It is completely silent. My understanding is that one of the, challenges is that, animals have to be especially careful because they don't hear the car, they don't hear it coming, But it is also a situation where when you turn on the key, you don't hear that vroom vroom that we're used to hearing in our internal combustion engine. So, it's just a completely quiet ride. It is, as I say, a Highlander, so you're driving in sort of SUV kind of experience. And it has all the bells and whistles. It has the GPS system and, radio. You're not sort of in a prototype. It is a little nerve-wracking to feel like you're driving in a $1 million vehicle, especially here in Southern California, where people can drive fairly aggressively, but it's just a very comfortable ride and very smooth and gets, a much higher fuel efficiency, although the capacity of the, engine is something you have to watch, and because we can't just pull over and fill up wherever we'd like, right now with only a prototype, we do have to kind of keep our travel distance is restricted, so we know we won't get ourselves into trouble.
Well, I know that one of the objectives for a company like Toyota is to have you folks drive this car. They want you to put it through the test. How do you manage to get that car circulated throughout the city to make sure it's being driven on a regular basis?
Well, the city council members, the city manager, some of our public works staff have all been certified by Toyota to drive the vehicle. We try and take it with us places where we also have the opportunity to let people know that we have the hydrogen hybrid fuel cell vehicle with us so that people can take a look at it. So we just, you know, get it out and about. It says, you know, fuel cell hybrid vehicle on the side of it. So for anybody paying attention as we're driving along, we occasionally get the thumbs up or high sign. And otherwise, it's just, you know, being put to use in the course of our daily activities. In every way, one could easily forget that you're driving the vehicle, except that it's so quiet.
The city of Irvine is an amazing... You guys are really on the cutting edge here, I think. And for people who might want to find out more about what's going on in Irvine, what would you recommend they do?
Well, they should go to our website, which is cityofirvine.org, and they can find information out about all of our green building recycling programs. You know, I also want to mention that the city of Irvine was truly a leader back in the 70s when we were the first city in America to have curbside recycling, but also we were the first city in America to ban chlorofluorocarbons in our city. And at the time, we're sort of, I wasn't on the council at the time, but the leadership at the time was sort of laughed at, and then a lot of people followed suit. And so, in fact, when it came to trying to have a positive impact on what was then the emerging notion of our human impact on the ozone layer, Irvine was in leadership. So I'm pleased that we now have reinvigorated our commitment to be a leader in this country on issues of this nature, and look forward to working with others and other communities and other leaders in this you know, city leaders in this country to see if we can't expedite what I think we all agree needs to happen, and that is to create a model wherein not necessarily every city can do everything, but everybody can do something. And I think citizens as well are interested in knowing how they can be actively engaged in ensuring a brighter future for our country and ensuring that we're leaving to future generations the resources that we've been blessed to enjoy in our own lifetime.
Well, this is a difficult question, but I think it is an important question. And that is, what is it about Irvine? What is it about that city, just south of L.A., that you think has led to this unique effort to really be a leader?
Well, I think leadership has made a difference. You know, at the risk of being a little self-congratulatory, it actually does take people in leadership who see their responsibility as being more than filling potholes and trimming trees. And, you know, one of my predecessors, Larry Agron, was a major leader in the 70s and 80s in advancing these issues. And when I came on the council in 2000, he and I worked together to continue to advance them. And then when I became mayor in 2004, I decided there were certain things I wanted to ensure we accomplished during my term as mayor. And we've been very aggressive about pursuing those. I also believe that we have to be willing to sit down with all of the stakeholders at the table. You need to have the business community engaged. This isn't something where we're going to achieve a great deal by imposing requirements on others. I think this is something where we will accomplish far more if we engage in an integrated conversation about where the value is in these initiatives for all of the parties who are at the table. And that's what we've done. Our green building program is a voluntary program, but we're seeing voluntary compliance. And at the end of the day, that in itself is a much more sustainable model for the future, because then it does not become subject to the political swinging of the pendulum, but rather becomes part of a culture of a community. And that's what we're trying to do here. Irvine is 35 years old, so we are a newer city. In that time, we've grown from a city of about 17,000 to a city of 185,000. We have a very active business community. We're a very culturally diverse community. We're a city that's been recognized as the safest city in America, as a great community for young people. we have a lot to be proud of, but we also, you know, with privilege comes responsibility. And I think that we have a responsibility here in Orange County, which is a county of 3 million people, and a county which is challenged with all of the things that any major metropolitan area is challenged with, to show that there are ways to take steps in the right direction. I think that's what Irvine's trying to do.
UC Irvine has always been a leader in advancing technologies. I'm curious what role you think they've played in terms of the emergence of Irvine as this model.
We are working very closely with the university and have engaged graduate students at the university to help us envision what we might be doing in terms of innovative technologies at the Great Park. So I think we have some real opportunities to leverage both the academic and the municipal and the corporate environments to showcase what can be done when people are thinking creatively and working collaboratively.
Well, I'm hoping that this showcase can become a commonplace around the country, that your message will get out there and people can turn to what's happening in Irvine as a model. It's being done. It can be done. We've been talking with Beth Crom, mayor of Irvine, just south of L.A. Beth Crom, thanks so much for adding your voice here to the Wildside News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, between now and next week, I want each of you to get involved in your local elections. Become informed. Take a stand, speak up, and speak out. Change is coming to a neighborhood near you. Next week, we go in-depth on the environment and the elections. Until next Thursday, or any time on the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your Voice of the Earth delivers here on the Wildside News.